This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. On Thursday, August 4th, the Biden administration declared monkeypox a public health emergency. The announcement followed the news of thousands of cases in the United States, with only a handful in Kansas and Missouri. However, the disease and its symptoms remain a mystery to many people. Today, Dr. Dana Hawkinson of Infectious Diseases at the KU Med Center explains the disease, how it spread, symptoms, and to look out for, and vaccines as well. Monkeypox has produced an unexpected side effect, a renewed stigma against gay and bisexual men. While the disease primarily affects queer men, it doesn't exclusively infect them, and that rhetoric can prove dangerous to LGBTQ communities. Dr. Katie Batza of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at KU will tell us why that rhetoric is harmful, drawing on the similar history of HIV and AIDS. Katie Batza joins us now. She's also the author of Before AIDS, Gay Health Politics in the 1970s. Katie, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's begin by with this. Who's primarily affected by monkeypox, Katie?
Well, right now, the reported cases, over 95% of them are in men who have sex with men. So a lot of bisexual, queer-identified individuals, as well as a small number of other folks as well.
So one thing you wonder about is, has the government given monkeypox adequate attention here? What has been the response?
You know, it's been a really frustrating response, honestly. This is a pretty easy stress test. We already had vaccines. We already had tests available. We already understood how the disease kind of worked. And at every single hurdle, we kind of fumbled the ball. And so it's been quite frustrating here. I think that the government has really been trying to kind of thread the needle of not overly stigmatizing this community, which is important. And yet they've done so at kind of the peril of the reality that mid-June, we had less than 100 cases nationally, and now we're over 11,000. I think it's pretty frustrating for a lot of folks.
Dr. Dana Hawkinson joins us now again. He's an infectious diseases professor at the KU Med Center. Dr. Hawkinson, it's always good to have you on the show. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
Do you agree that the government has fumbled the ball here, Dr. Hawkinson?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certainly steps that could have been taken. You know, just like we've heard, we went through the beginning of one pandemic 2 years ago, thought we could have been prepared. I think it is frustrating because of the knowledge that we do have vaccines available. We have treatments available. Testing is available. I think there is a reasonable amount of frustration around that. And I think most importantly, it is getting those vaccines into the arms of people that are most at risk.
You know, to what extent, Dr. Hawkinson, did we end up fumbling the ball, again, to use that metaphor here, because the country was so invested in COVID and maybe so weary of COVID at the same time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, it starts with the vaccine supply. And we knew that, I think it was 2017 or a couple years after that, we had 20 million doses of these vaccines, specifically the Jynneos, which we are using for active vaccination right now against monkeypox, had those expire. So I think that was it. Our national stockpile of that vaccine, that specific vaccine, then became exceedingly small, and now we are trying to deal with that. But I think there's also other caveats and other issues that have been going on. You know, we know the company that makes that vaccine has been shut down so that it can expand its operations. This was done prior to the current outbreak of monkeypox. So I think that was another part that has been extremely frustrating. I am hopeful that with the new dosing strategy of the vaccine and being able to expand the amount of vaccine that we currently have, that we can now more efficiently get those vaccine doses into those arms of people. And I know here at the health system, we have started vaccinating last week. So we are still waiting. Obviously, we work with KDHE, who's working with Health and Human Services, for those allocations of those vaccine doses. But I think moving forward, that is going to be our best strategy, and thankful at least we can somewhat expand our supply currently.
Well, a couple of points here, Dana. You said you started vaccinating last week. Does that suggest that health centers across the country are now up and running and offering those vaccinations going forward?
You know, I think it's going to be heterogeneous, really. If you look at New York and San Francisco, who has a large number of cases, we know they were started a week ago or so. And so I think it's just going to be different depending on really what community you are in. You know, I think here in the Midwest in general, it's probably a little bit behind, but we know that there are just so many cases, you know, out on the coast, again, specifically in those areas that I talked about. They're very proactive, have been able to do that. Hopefully, as we now have got those first allocations from Health and Human Services out to those states, we can more readily get it into those communities. We know that Kansas City, Missouri, has talked about how they are getting doses and going to be setting up all of those processes to get the people in the community vaccinated as well. So I think the ability and those allocations of actual doses getting to those centers to where they need to be so they can get them to the public, that is improving. And hopefully we'll have vast improvements over this next week.
Katie Batza, I gather that you're suggesting here that those vaccines should have been available sooner than now.
I mean, you know, there are certain limitations, and it's unfortunate the way that this unfolded. But I agree with Dr. Hawkinson that we are seeing a pretty significant shift in the direction that this is going right now. And so we should see significant improvements in terms of access of the vaccine and whatnot. But I think the way that this has played out in a way that I think a lot of people in public health were hoping that after COVID-19, we would be better at, you know, addressing public health epidemics and potential surges of new illnesses. And yet I think it actually has shown us kind of the opposite. We have a lot of work to do and a lot of things that need kind of fine tuning, funding and hard work.
Well, Katie, that's a little discouraging, isn't it? Dr. Batza, I mean, given COVID, given we just had a recent experience with this, and here we are talking about holes in the system, that's a little hard to hear.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I want to be really clear. I don't think it's a failure of any of our public health workers. I think it's just the reality of the fact that it's been a system that's been really underfunded for several decades. And, you know, after 2 years of the extreme pressures that our public health workers have faced under COVID, this is a challenging thing. Just as for the LGBTQ community, COVID was particularly challenging for them as well. You know, this is a community where oftentimes their family is their community. And so having to kind of separate from that community for a significant amount of time because of social distancing and whatnot, they're kind of tired and frustrated just like everybody else that now here comes this next wave of something new.
Katie, we've heard so much on this program over the last few years about the underfunding of America's public health system. Are you seeing changes, a reversal of course here, or is it still status quo when it comes to funding of our public health?
I mean, I think honestly, it's been so underfunded for so long that it's kind of created almost a shell of a system that doesn't really work. And so not only do we need to provide more funding, in my opinion, I think we also need to look at some of the ways in which things like vaccines or treatments or testing are allocated with our various health systems, whether it's through a public health center or a clinic or a hospital.
You know, Dana Hawkinson, Dr. Hawkinson, you said a few minutes ago that the government allowed 20 million monkeypox doses to expire. How unusual is that?
You know, I don't think that's anything unusual. We know that medical items, drugs do have shelf lives. They are studied when they are active. We know that shelf lives are obtained and decided on from different methods. We know that the shelf life for the COVID-19 home test was extended for 6 months by the manufacturer after there's more studying and going about that. So medications expiring is nothing new, and it's not unusual then, because certainly you want something that's going to be active. So if there's an expiration date on there and something does happen, it's vitally important to make sure you're giving it within that expiration date, not after, so that you can be when you are giving those things to people, you know that they are going to be effective.
Let's slow down and just backtrack just a little bit, Dr. Hawkinson. What is monkeypox?
So monkeypox is a viral illness. It was discovered in the 1950s. The first human case was discovered in the 1970s. It is a virus, though. It doesn't, the host, the normal host, so that's the normal person or normal animal that has the virus, is not monkeys nor humans. It is believed to be a type of rodent. But we didn't really see disease from that. It wasn't really talked about. Why? Because there was, at the same time, there was massive worldwide vaccination programs going on against smallpox. We have the luck in understanding that the smallpox vaccine does provide cross-reactive immunity and protection against monkeypox. So while that was going on, you had all these populations that were getting vaccinated for smallpox. They had protection against monkeypox. So you didn't really see the cases. Now for quite a few years, a couple decades, and especially since 2017, we know that there have been local outbreaks in those Western country, those African countries, which have monkeypox, most notably Nigeria, and then, of course, Democratic Republic of the Congo as well. This current clade or strain of virus of monkeypox is from that Nigerian area. The overall disease process is not too severe. We know the death rate can be about 1% in those resource poor countries, but think about the quality of life, the daily quality of life that is decreased when you have this disease. It is much like chickenpox in the fact that you get a lot of those lesions, those pustules on your skin, on your body, and typically it will last 2 to 4 weeks. You are still infectious until those lesions scab over and fall off. But what we are seeing now, so that is the typical. Again, that has been going on. There's been a large, fairly large outbreak going on in Nigeria since about 2017. Why couldn't we have gotten vaccines to that? Why couldn't we have done something to stop it there? So move ahead now. We know that there was a monkeypox outbreak in the United States in 2003. This was associated with prairie dogs that were housed with animals that had it in the Midwest. And several states were affected by that. But we've dealt with this before. So now we move into 2022 in this current outbreak. Again, monkeypox, viral illness, where we are seeing it has spread, and we heard your guest talk about it earlier, is in these dense communities. Vast majority of the people that have been affected are MSM, men who have sex with men. But we also know there are bisexual men in there who have sex with men and women as well. But it has really been concentrated in these dense social networks and things of that nature. So I think the important thing to remember here is that this is where we are seeing the vast majority of cases, but that does not mean that is where it is going to stay. And if we have any historical view on this, we know that diseases don't stop at county lines, at community lines, at opinions on politics. We know that it gets into other populations as well. So I think it's vitally important to be as very aggressive as we can. And I think the MSM, the gay community, the LGBT community is extremely informed to have been their best advocates on this and have helped each other out to help try and avoid and reduce the risk of getting it. But right now we need to continue going 100 miles an hour trying to get these vaccines into these people that are most at risk, and see where we go from there.
Well, Dr. Hawkinson, now that the vaccines are getting disseminated across the country, should we expect the numbers to begin to drop and maybe drop fairly fairly quickly here?
You know, I don't know in what time frame we're talking about. We certainly hope so. I think there is still currently, number one, a lag of reporting, a lag of testing. I think it will take really a couple to few weeks to play out and see what happens. So it's really hard to say exactly what, again, is it going to, now that we are having colleges go back to school, how is that going to affect it? We know young people like to be, you know, in social environments and be close together. Is that going to impact it at all? So I think it's important to understand we still have some lag, obviously, in vaccination, but also testing and evaluation as well. It's gotten better. There still is that lag. And I think, again, it goes to that infrastructure that was talked about. And it's not the The public health workers, we know that they are exhausted. They are working as hard as they can. They are doing what they can with the limited resources they have. It's just that whole general infrastructure that I think we've been talking about that has aided in this.
Right.
Hopefully it will get better, and hopefully as more people start to get vaccinated and develop that immunity, we can certainly see a slowdown in this disease that really affects your quality of life quite significantly for those 2 to 4 weeks that you have to be isolated.
It sounds like you're saying you don't want to catch this.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. You know, it it causes significant quality of life because of the pain associated with it. Having to be isolated, it's not like COVID where you're maybe isolated for 5 days or 7 days and then you can go back to work. In this type of instance, you really need to be isolated until those lesions, those pox lesions that you develop from this disease, are scabbed over and fall off. And at that point, you're no longer infectious.
I thought your point a few minutes ago about college campuses was interesting. Obviously, we're all going back into the classroom here in the next week or so. Should college campuses be thinking about some kind of vaccination campaign to sort of nip this in the bud going forward?
Well, I think we need to wait on certainly on some recommendations by you know the public health guiding bodies such as the CDC and the
but you don't want to wait too long on that because classes start next Monday, Doctor.
But correct, we don't want to wait too long. But we know the vast majority of colleges have those plans in place. We know the University of Kansas and Lawrence has been in discussions with that as well, along as with their COVID. And I think we should also point out it's important because we know the young people are going to be socializing, being close together. But I think it's important to understand also how this virus is not transmitted. And really, our best evidence, our best data support the fact that getting this virus is difficult. You need that close, intimate contact, that skin-to-skin contact. It's not going into a classroom. It's not shaking hands with somebody. It is by the close, intimate contact, not those other social interactions. And so I think we need to also tell people how it's not transmitted so they don't have to have that anxiety. But I'll always continue to support the fact that you also need to be doing good hand hygiene and washing your hands before doing things such as eating, shaking hands with people, doing it after, all things of that nature as well.
You know, Katie, given what Dr. Hawkinson said about the fact that the monkeypox spreads among men having sex with other men, to what extent do you see similarities between the responses, the one for AIDS a number of years ago and then this current one for monkeypox?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately, a little bit of the slow response is somewhat similar, although now it's picking up much faster initially. It took 6 years for the president to even say the word HIV/AIDS out loud at the beginning of the AIDS pandemic. So this is quite a different set of circumstances.
That was President Reagan or the first President Bush?
That was President Reagan, yeah. Mm-hmm. And by that time, more people had been infected than had, more Americans had been infected than had been murdered or killed in the Vietnam War. And so just to give us a little sense of... the numbers. Yeah. So this is a much different situation, but I do think that there are some similarities. One of them is that the LGBTQ community is really concerned about how stigma is going to play out here. In the countries where this is already endemic, this isn't really associated with the LGBTQ community. It's often children. And so, you know, I think that the public health sector has done a really good job, actually, as they have kind of started speaking up more and more about this. They've done a much better job at explaining that this is impacting this community, but it is certainly not just about this community. And it's nothing that we need to be like attacking this community for. It just happened to kind of crop up here. And so, you know, we all need to be kind of aware of monkeypox and not stigmatize the entire community about it. So that's been helpful. And I also think that one of the major differences between these two is that HIV and AIDS, you know, for the first 7 years, but really the first 15 years, you were looking at a life expectancy of generally around 6 to 12 months. And so here, you know, the death rate is 1%. It's excruciating for the 2 to 4 weeks that you have it, but it's not going to kill you. So that obviously is is great.
To what extent are you seeing people stigmatizing those who have contracted monkeypox? Katie, what are you seeing out there on that front?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, unfortunately, it's kind of the usual suspects who are often kind of trying to point the fingers at either minority groups or LGBTQ folks, or just trying to kind of find a scapegoat so that they don't actually have to do the work of repairing the public health system. And so I think that we see some government leaders taking on that position. We see some community activists, but I think honestly, conversations about monkeypox are also a little bit quiet and dulled. All of us are a little numb to the idea of another health crisis.
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case, isn't it? I mean, we just don't want to think about this stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which is both, it kind of keeps us from having a lot of very vocal stigma, but also it leaves us vulnerable to misinformation and to not caring and to not knowing about what we need to do to take care of ourselves.
So what would you say when it comes to, you know, what we can learn, how we can learn from our mistakes that we made back in the 80s with AIDS and HIV?
Well, I think one thing is really talking openly about different kinds of contact and not having a stigma and an assumption. I think in HIV and AIDS, the early years, there was a lot of stigma around intimate contact of any kind, and that really shouldn't be happening with anyone, but definitely not LGBTQ communities unless you were married. And so now I think as a society, we have kind of a more honest understanding that people hang out with each other. They have more intimate contacts. They have more skin-to-skin contacts. And so there's a lessening of stigma. There's a more understanding and realistic viewpoint and kind of a more sex-positive rather than sex-shaming reality at play. And how you see that play out with the monkeypox conversation is that even though it's not solely sexually transmitted, I think there's a much more awareness that this is a normal interaction, that people hang out together, they go to parties, they touch one another, and that is an acceptable thing.
You're saying it's a very much of a different day right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Dr. Hawkinson, if people are wondering about symptoms here and if you're contracting this disease, which no one wants to have, how would you know you're getting it?
Well, you do have typical symptoms of other viral illnesses, such as fever, aches. You can have some cough. You can have lymphadenopathy, which is an enlargement of your lymph nodes. You know, particularly you're going to be looking at those lymph nodes, maybe where you contracted the disease if it was due to skin contact. So you're talking about in your groin. Other lymphadenopathy can be other areas depending on how and where you contracted. So you're going to have those swollen lymph nodes along with the fever, possible cough, aches. But then, of course, you're going to have these skin lesions. And this is what led it initially to being such difficult diagnosis when it first came onto the scene this time, is because you will have these lesions. They could look like little blisters. They could look like little pimples, just little areas in your skin that maybe weren't there. Over time, they will evolve into blisters. And then even an umbilicated form of a type of blister, and that means there's an indention in the middle, they will eventually rupture or start to drain and then scab over. So those are going to be the main symptoms. The one nice thing about this infection that we understand so far is that you really are not contagious. You are really not spreading it to others unless you are having symptoms. And that is in direct contrast to SARS-CoV-2, where you know you could be spreading that disease prior to having any symptoms whatsoever. So those are the main symptoms that someone would be looking for. But, of course, it's going to be the skin lesions that are really going to tell the tale.
And the pain comes from the blisters, doctor? Do I have that right?
So the pain can come from the blisters, but also what we're seeing, you know, in this current atypical form of disease where we are having a lot of intimate close contact. And it's that rubbing of the skin in those areas. We're also having significant pain in the anogenital region, and that is what is causing a lot of people to have to go to the hospital. This is really not a hospitalization disease. Mm-hmm. Most people will not have to, but because of the severe pain, say where the lesions may be, you know, on the penis, in the anus, around those intimate parts, that can cause a lot of pain, and you're needing to go to the hospital for pain relief and symptomatic relief.
Wow. Hey, how and where can people get tested and vaccinated then right now, Dr. Hawkinson?
Yeah. So the best thing to do right now for vaccination, we do have vaccine at the health system. We are offering it to our patients that are otherwise who self-describe themselves as high risk, because right now that is who should be getting the vaccine. The vaccine is allocated from Health and Human Services to the state health departments. From there, the state health departments will decide where the allocation goes, whether it's to larger health systems, whether it's to county health departments. So the best thing for you to do is to contact your primary care physician, who then should contact the county health department for further instructions on vaccination itself. Testing right now is done through KDHE, but we also know they have There are authorizations for private labs to do testing as well. Mm-hmm. So that is how that will happen with testing. You know, if you think or suspect, the best thing to do is to call your primary care physician for further instructions on what to do,
gotcha.
How to get, do you come into their office and get tested, things of that nature. But right now, you know, seeing how things move, and we heard the guests say things are moving quite rapidly right now as far as vaccine availability, testing, all of those things are progressing quite rapidly and are light years ahead of where they were even at the beginning of last week.
Wow.
So we're going to, hopefully it will be a lot easier to get vaccinated. And especially it's going to be better to be able to vaccinate, especially those high risk groups right now with our expanded coverage from the new dosing of the vaccine.
It's going to be really interesting to see if the numbers begin to drop, given the picture that you're describing. That's Dr. Dana Hawkinson, an infectious diseases professor over at the KU Med Center. We were also joined by Katie Batza, who's the author of Before AIDS, Gay Health Politics in the 1970s. She teaches over at KU. Thank you both for an informative conversation. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.